welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, here to help as holiday shopping gets down to the wire. It's a jungle out there, at the mall, I mean. Together now, we'll explore some titles that are under the tree worthy for your diverse group of friends and family. So settle in and take just a wee bit of well-deserved time off as we turn to page one of the Book Report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineer stone, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And since 'tis the season to make dreams come true, Lifestyles Kitchens offers full or partial gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's. lifestyleskitchens.com. Happy holidays! Debbie McComber rings in the season with her whimsical holiday novel, Angels at the Table. The return of Shirley, goodness, and mercy delivers laugh, love, and a charming dose of angelic intervention. An angel's work is never done, especially during the holidays. With Will, an apprentice angel, under their wings, Shirley, goodness, and mercy descend on Times Square on New Year's Eve to join in the festivities. Will spies two lonely strangers in the crowd and decides midnight is the perfect time to lend a heavenly helping hand. Lucy and Aaron meet after bumping into each other in the crowds at Times Square. They instantly hit it off and find they have much in common. Lucy's an up-and-coming chef, and Aaron a respected food critic. But just as quickly as they're brought together, another twist of fate tears them apart with no way to reconnect. 1 year later, Lucy is the chef of an acclaimed new restaurant, and Aaron is a successful columnist for a major New York newspaper. For all the time that's passed, the two have not forgotten their one serendipitous evening. To reunite the young couple, Shirley, goodness, mercy, and Will cook up a brilliant plan, mixing true love, a second chance, and a generous sprinkle of mischief to create a warm and wonderful holiday tale. Kimberly Farr narrates.
This is Earth, Mercy informed their young charge with a tinge of pride. For all its problems, Earth was a fascinating place to visit, with the tall buildings that butted up against the sky and people milling about with such purpose, most of them unaware of the spiritual world that surrounded them. More times than she could remember, Mercy had lost patience with humans. Those who were considered the apex of God's creations appeared to be slow-witted and spiritually dull. Yet she loved them and treasured her earthly assignments. "It's New York," Shirley added, resting her chin in her hands as she gazed longingly below. "Oh, I do so love this city." "Manhattan, to be more precise," goodness clarified, and ended with a little sigh, indicating that she, too, had missed visiting Earth. The four hovered near Times Square, watching the clamoring crowds jockeying for space on New Year's Eve. Will's eyes widened as he intently studied the scene taking place in the streets below. "Is it always like this? So busy and crowded, I mean?" "No, no, this is a special night. The people are gathering together to usher in the new year." Time was a concept reserved for Earth. In heaven, it was much different. Consequently, the time restriction placed on the three prayer ambassadors when given earthly assignments had caused more than one problem. Did Gabriel want us? Gabriel? Shirley gasped and quickly cut him off. He doesn't exactly know that we've brought you here. It would probably be best if you didn't mention this short visit to him, okay? Yes, please. It would be best not to let anyone know we've shown you Earth. It went without saying they'd be in all kinds of trouble if Gabriel learned what they'd been up to. Gabriel means well, but he tends to get a little prickly about these things, Goodness explained to their young charge. Why is that? Will stared at all three of them. Well, you see, the three of us, thought we should give you a bird's-eye view of Earth and these people God loves so much, strictly for training purposes. Mercy looked to her friends to expound upon their intentions, which were honorable, if not a tad bit sneaky. This earthly visitation had been a spur-of-the-moment decision. Mercy had been the one to suggest it. Naturally, Goodness was quick to agree, and after some discussion, Shirley had seen the light as well. Will, an apprentice angel, had been placed under their charge, and given this honor, it was only right that he get a glimpse of the trials and tribulations that awaited him once he started working as a prayer ambassador. The job could be a bit tricky, and the more Will understood the idiosyncrasies of humans, the better he would do once given an assignment from Gabriel. Mercy was certain that under their tutorship, Will would make a fine prayer ambassador one day. He was young and enthusiastic, eager to learn about Earth and the role he would play. As Mercy, who had falsely been labeled a troublemaker, had pointed out, theirs was a duty that required serious dedication. She wasn't alone in believing this. Goodness, oh, poor Goodness, had gotten something of a reputation, too, and Mercy felt partially to blame, but that was another story entirely. Shirley tended to be a bit more on the straight and narrow path and had worked hard to reform her friends. In fact, Shirley, a former guardian angel, had done such a marvelous job, Gabriel had offered to let them train the promising young angel who was with them now.
We've just heard Angels at the Table by Debbie McComber. Timekeeper, Mitch Albom's new work of fiction, the inventor of the world's first clock is punished for trying to measure God's greatest gift. He is banished to a cave for centuries and forced to listen to voices of all who come after him seeking more days, more years. Eventually, with his soul nearly broken, Father Time is granted his freedom, along with a magical hourglass and a mission. A chance to redeem himself by teaching two earthly people the true meaning of time. He returns to our world, now dominated by the hour counting he so innocently began, and commences a journey with two unlikely partners, a teenage girl about to give up on life, and a wealthy old businessman who wants to live forever. To save himself, he must save them both. This original tale inspires us to reconsider our own notions of time, how we spend it, and how truly precious it is. Dan Stevens narrates.
This is a story about the meaning of time, and it begins long ago, at the dawn of man's history, with a barefoot boy running up a hillside. Ahead of him is a barefoot girl. He is trying to catch her. This is often the way it is between girls and boys. For these two, it is the way it will always be. The boy's name is Dor. The girl is Ali. At this age, they are nearly the same size, with high-pitched voices and thick, dark hair, their faces splashed with mud. As Ali runs, she looks back at Dor and grins. What she feels are the first stirrings of love. She scoops a small rock and tosses it high in his direction. Dor! She yells. Dor, as he runs, is counting his breaths. He's the first person on Earth to attempt this. Counting. Making numbers. He began by matching one finger to another, giving each pairing a sound and a value. Soon he was counting anything he could. Dor is gentle, an obedient child, but his mind goes deeper than those around him. He is different. And on this early page of man's story, one different child can change the world. Which is why God is watching him. "Dor!" Ali yells. He looks up and smiles. He always smiles at Ali. And the stone falls at his feet. He cocks his head and forms a thought. "Throw another!" Ali throws it high. Dor counts his fingers. A sound for one. A sound for two. He is tackled from behind by a third child, Nim, a boy much larger and stronger. Nim crows as he puts a knee in Dor's back.
"I am king!"
All three children laugh. They resume their running. Try to imagine a life without timekeeping. You probably can't. You know the month, the year, the day of the week. There's a clock on your wall or the dashboard of your car. You have a schedule, a calendar, a time for dinner or a movie. Yet all around you, timekeeping is ignored. Birds are not late. A dog does not check its watch. Deer do not fret over passing birthdays. Man alone measures time. Man alone chimes the hour. And because of this, man alone suffers a paralyzing fear that no other creature endures. A fear of time running out. 3. Sarah Lemon fears time is running out. She steps from the shower and calculates. 20 minutes to blow dry her hair, 30 minutes for makeup, 30 minutes to dress, 15 minutes to get there. 8:30. The bedroom door opens. Her mother, Lorraine.
"Honey? Knock, Mom."
"Okay, knock, knock." Lorraine eyes the bed. She sees options laid out. 2 pairs of jeans, 3 t-shirts, a white sweater.
"Where are you going?" "Nowhere."
"Are you meeting someone?"
"No."
"You look good in the white."
"Mom!"
Lorraine sighs. She lifts a wet towel from the floor and leaves. Sarah returns to the mirror. She thinks about the boy. She pinches the fat around her waist. Ugh. 8:30. She is definitely not wearing the white. Victor Delamont fears time is running out. He and Grace step from the elevator into their penthouse.
"Give me your coat," Grace says.
She hangs it in the closet. It is quiet. Victor uses a cane to move down the hallway past the large oil painting by a French master. His abdomen is throbbing. He should take a pill. He enters his study, filled with books and plaques and a huge mahogany desk. Victor thinks about the doctor. "There's not much we can do." What does that mean? Months? Weeks? Is this the end of him? This can't be the end of him.
We've just heard The Timekeeper by Mitch Albom. Lisa Lillian, a.k.a. Hungry Girl, is a New York Times best-selling author and the creator of HungryGirl.com, the kitchen-conquering daily email that informs and entertains. Lisa is a typical woman battling the same food issues we all struggle with. Lisa is not a nutritionist, rather a foodologist. She celebrates how wonderful food is and how much of it she can eat and still fit into her clothes. More than 1 million fans get the daily Hungry Girl email with recipes, supermarket finds, survival guides, and tips and tricks. What started as a daily email to friends and family has turned into a nationwide phenomenon. In addition to emails, Lisa starred in the Hungry Girl TV show, plus she's made guest appearances all over TV. She's a regular contributor to many popular magazines And she's the author of best-selling books, four of which debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Her most recent book, To the Max, The Ultimate Guilt-Free Cookbook, is what we'll focus on today. Welcome, Lisa. I am thrilled to have you as a guest on the Book Report.
Well, thanks for having me.
First, tell us about the creation of Hungry Girl. What got you started?
I started Hungry Girl back in 2004. I've always been food obsessed. I'm not a nutritionist. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a dietitian. I'm just hungry. And so I thought there was sort of like a space or a hole in the market for information that was more fun and relatable and less serious, but still really helpful. And that's what inspired me to start Hungry Girl as a daily email service back then.
Yeah, I received your daily email. It's written in such an entertaining style. How do you get it out each day?
Well, thank you, first of all. It's really fun to work on, and basically, we run Hungry Girl almost like a daily newspaper. I mean, when I first started, it was just me, and then I had a graphic designer who worked with me. But the brand has grown organically, and now there are about 12 of us who work on all the content. So, we're working hard constantly to produce everything and get the best, most fun, and, you know, helpful, informative information out there every single day.
Your previous books have had titles like 200 Under 200 and Supermarket Survival. Your new book is To the Max. What is the inspiration behind this one?
Well, this is the seventh book, and it's the sixth cookbook, and To the Max really is the Hungry Girl Bible. And there are 650 recipes. I thought it was time to just have a huge, all-inclusive book that included all the classics and things like Hungry Girl faux fries and egg mugs and growing oatmeal bowls, as well as party foods and cocktails and desserts. So 650 recipes. I mean, the book is 3.5 pounds.
And what is your test kitchen like?
Oh, it's the most fun place ever. The test kitchen, I wish I could be there every single day. I'm sad that I have to travel, but we're just constantly trying out new things, and it's a little bit like a lab, and I'm definitely like a mad scientist, and it's just a lot of chewing and a lot of laughing.
Now, if someone is new to your ideology, should they pick up one book before they pick up another?
Well, I think that the latest book, Hungry Girl to the Max, it really is all-encompassing. So I think if you've missed the past books, this book really does it all. I always will love 200 Under 200 because it's a great book for mini meals and snack ideas. And also, Supermarket Survival is really helpful because that helps people navigate the supermarket aisles, people who may be new to this way of eating. So I hope that's an answer. I mean, the short answer is I think Hungry Girl to the Max if you really want a Hungry Girl cookbook of classics.
Yeah. Well, in addition to your daily email, you are doing books and tours and TV. How do you manage it all?
I don't sleep a lot, but I really love it. So I always say if you do what you love, it doesn't feel like work. And so I don't mind working 12 or 15 hours a day, and I love helping people, and touring is actually the most fun. So just getting to meet the fans of Hungry Girl, people who I've helped over the years, is the greatest.
You've been a guest on many TV shows like Rachel Ray, Dr. Oz, Today. Tell us a favorite behind-the-scenes story.
Well, I love them all, and I love Dr. Oz. He's like the nicest person ever, and he was so cute. One day we did a rehearsal, and it was freezing in the studio, and he took off his sweatshirt, and he made me wear his sweatshirt, which I thought was really adorable. And also, I don't know if anyone knows this, but he still performs surgery on Thursdays. So in addition to being a TV show host, he is performing surgery. So I thought that was pretty cool.
No, I didn't. Well, okay, holiday season coming up. Any survival tips?
Yeah, I would say for the holidays, it's all about planning. So I think people tend to make excuses. And so if you know you have a cocktail party or a big lunch or a big dinner, you should plan around that for the day. And don't skip meals and save up your calories for a party or anything like that, because you end up overeating. And also up the exercise.
Now, is one of your cookbooks more kind of party-centric than others?
Well, the new one has a whole slew of party recipes. The very first one has some as well. But definitely Hungry Girl to the Max has the most party recipes, along with cocktails, which, you know, you can't go wrong with cocktails.
Beverages are a key element of any holiday party.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what's next for you?
I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. The daily emails are continuing on and going strong. There's another book coming out in the spring, and that's another 200 under 200 dessert book that I'm really excited about. That's only desserts. And, you know, keep doing more Dr. Oz appearances. I'm going to be fairly regularly appearing on that show.
Yes, desserts are kind of important to me, too. So, all right, readers, I want to tell you that check the Hungry Girl website for appearances when you can actually meet Lisa. And this is a phenomenon that even if you don't need to lose a pound or two, worth definitely checking into. Thank you so much, Lisa, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's good talking to you.
All righty, bye-bye. And now, just in time for holiday parties, let's get a taste of something essential. Hungry Girl, the official survival guide. Tips and treats for guilt-free eating. Lisa Lillian, who narrates, presents survival strategies for anyone who wants to make guilt-free eating choices. Anywhere, anytime, including cocktail time.
Here are my very best general tips for dining out. And I'll be focusing on American food here. I'll get into the other foods like Mexican, Italian, sushi, etc. a little later. Tip number one, don't starve yourself before a big meal out. People do this all the time. They save up their calories before going out, and then they show up at a restaurant starving. This is a really bad idea. If you do that, you may attack the breadbasket when it arrives and make some really bad choices when you order. So eat normally throughout the day, and you won't be super hungry by the time you get to the restaurant. And drink a glass or two of water when you get there. Tip number two, don't be shy and don't be afraid to special order. If something comes with sauce, you can ask for it on the side. Always ask for what you want. Just be nice about it and ask questions if you have any. If you want to know how something's prepared, ask and they'll tell you. Tip number three, make Google your best friend. If you know where you're going to eat, look up the restaurant online and become familiar with the menu. That way you won't be surprised once you get there. Now, I do this all the time. My husband actually makes fun of me, but it's really helpful. Also, chain restaurants will sometimes have all the nutritional information online already, and that can obviously help you make better choices as well. So go online and do your homework. And my final general tip is this. Don't go crazy with the cocktails. Not only are they high in calories, but it's also much harder to turn down triple chocolate cake when you're a little tipsy.
We've just heard the official survival guide, Tips and Tricks for Guilt-Free Eating by Lisa Lillian. The Book Report is pleased to present a gleeful tale of global conspiracy, complex code breaking, high-tech data visualization, young love, rollicking adventure, and the secret to eternal life, mostly set in a hole-in-the-wall San Francisco bookstore. In Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore by Robin Sloan, the Great Recession has shuffled Clay Janin out of his life as a San Francisco web designer and into a new gig working the night shift at Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore. But after a few days on the job, Clay begins to realize this store is even more curious than the name suggests. There are only a few customers. They come in repeatedly and never seem to actually buy anything. Instead, they are checking out impossibly obscure volumes from strange corners of the store, all according to some elaborate, long-standing arrangement with Mr. Penumbra. Is the store a front for something larger? With irresistible brio, Robin Sloan crafts an intelligent literary adventure story for the 21st century. It turns out, Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore is a place you may never want to leave. Ari Fliakos narrates.
I was also the voice of @NewBagel on Twitter and attracted a few hundred followers with a mix of breakfast trivia and digital coupons. None of this represented the glorious next stage of human evolution, but I was learning things. I was moving up. But then the economy took a dip, and it turns out that in a recession, people want good old-fashioned bubbly oblong bagels, not smooth alien spaceship bagels, not even if they're sprinkled with precision-milled rock salt. The ex-Googlers were accustomed to success, and they would not go quietly. They quickly rebranded to become the Old Jerusalem Bagel Company and abandoned the algorithm entirely so the bagels started coming out blackened and irregular. They instructed me to make the website look old-timey, a task that burdened my soul and earned me zero AIGA awards. The marketing budget dwindled, then disappeared. there was less and less to do. I wasn't learning anything, and I wasn't moving anywhere. Finally, the ex-Googlers threw in the towel and moved to Costa Rica. The ovens went cold, and the website went dark. There was no money for severance, but I got to keep my company-issued MacBook and the Twitter account. So then, after less than a year of employment, I was jobless. It turned out it was more than just the food chains that had contracted. People were living in motels and tent cities. The whole economy suddenly felt like a game of musical chairs, and I was convinced I needed to grab a seat, any seat, as fast as I could. That was a depressing scenario when I considered the competition. I had friends who were designers like me, but they had already designed world-famous websites or advanced touchscreen interfaces, not just a logo for an upstart bagel shop. I had friends who worked at Apple. My best friend, Neil, ran his own company. Another year at New Bagel and I would have been in good shape, but I hadn't lasted long enough to build my portfolio or even get particularly good at anything. I had an art school thesis on Swiss typography, 1957 to 1983, and I had a 3-page website. But I kept at it with the Help Wanted ads. My standards were sliding swiftly. At first, I had insisted I would only work at a company with a mission I believed in. Then I thought maybe it would be fine as long as I was learning something new. After that, I decided it just couldn't be evil. Now I was carefully delineating my personal definition of evil. It was paper that saved me. It turned out that I could stay focused on job hunting if I got myself away from the internet. So I would print out a ream of Help Wanted ads, drop my phone in a drawer, and go for a walk. I'd crumple up the ads that required too much experience and deposit them in dented green trash cans along the way. And so by the time I'd exhausted myself and hopped on a bus back home, I'd have 2 or 3 promising prospectuses folded in my back pocket, ready for follow-up. This routine did lead me to a job, though not in the way I had expected. San Francisco is a good place for walks if your legs are strong. The city is a tiny square, punctuated by steep hills and bounded on 3 sides by water. And as a result, there are surprise vistas everywhere. You'll be walking along, minding your own business with a fistful of printouts, and suddenly the ground will fall away, and you'll see straight down to the bay, with the buildings lit up orange and pink along the way. San Francisco's architectural style didn't really make inroads anywhere else in the country. And even when you live here and you're used to it, it lends the vistas a strangeness. All the tall, narrow houses, the windows like eyes and teeth, the wedding cake filigree. And looming behind it all, if you're facing the right direction, you'll see the rusty ghost of the Golden Gate Bridge. I had followed one strange vista down a line of steep stair-stepped sidewalks, then walked along the water, taking the very long way home. I had followed the line of old piers, carefully skirting the raucous chowder of Fisherman's Wharf, and watched seafood restaurants fade into nautical engineering firms and then social media startups. Finally, when my stomach rumbled, signaling its readiness for lunch, I had turned back in toward the city. Whenever I walked the streets of San Francisco, I'd watch for Help Wanted signs in windows, which is not something you really do, right? I should probably be more suspicious of those. Legitimate employers use Craigslist. Sure enough, the 24-hour bookstore did not have the look of a legitimate employer. Help wanted. Late shift. Specific requirements. Good benefits. Now, I was pretty sure 24-hour bookstore was a euphemism for something. It was on Broadway, in a euphemistic part of town. My help wanted hike had taken me far from home. The place next door was called Booties, and it had a sign with neon legs that crossed and uncrossed. I pushed the bookstore's glass door. It made a bell tinkle brightly up above, and I stepped slowly through. I did not realize at the time what an important threshold I had just crossed.
That was a sampling of Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore by Robin Sloan. The fans have spoken. Back to Blood is vintage Tom Wolfe. And since the book report's home is in Miami, we had to bring it to you. In the feverish landscape of my town, Miami, Wolfe introduces a cast of memorable characters who make up the city. The Cuban mayor, the black police chief, a muckraking young journalist, a billionaire porn addict, crack dealers, de-skilled conceptual artists at Art Basel, shady Russians, and so many others. Based on the detailed on-scene high-energy reporting that powered Tom Wolfe's classics, Back to Blood is a brilliant, spot-on, and often hilarious take of our times. Lou Diamond Phillips gets 5 stars for his fabulous narration.
In the cohort of gorgeous girls, however, the big girls are the first to cross that invisible boundary beyond which the best they can hope for is a very handsome woman, or quite striking, really. Mac, his wife, his Mac, the knife, had crossed that line. She sighed a sigh so deep she ended up expelling air between her teeth. You'd think they'd have parking valets at a restaurant like this. They charge enough.
That's true, he said. You're right. Joe Stonecrab, Azul, Cafe Abrazzi, and what's that restaurant at the Settai? They all have valet parking.
You're absolutely right. Your worldview is my Weltanschauung. How about if we talk about restaurants? A pause. I hope you know we're very late, Ed. It's 8:20. So we're already 20 minutes late, and we haven't found a place to park, and we've got 6 people in there waiting for us.
Well, I don't know what else. I did call Christian.
And you're supposed to be the host. Do you realize that? Has that registered with you at all?
Well, I called Christian and told him they should order some drinks. You can be sure Christian won't object to that. And Marietta won't either. Marietta and her cocktails. I don't even know anybody else who orders cocktails.
Or how about a little obiter dictum riff on cocktails or Marietta? Either one or both. All the same, it's just not nice keeping everybody waiting like this. I mean, really, I'm serious, Ed. This is so trifling. I just can't stand it. Now, this was his chance. This was the crack in the wall of words he was waiting for. An opening. It's risky, but... And almost in tune and on key, he sings songs. You. You. You edit my life. You are my wife. My Mac the knife. She began shaking her head from side to side. It doesn't seem to do me much good, does it? Never mind. What was that creeping so slyly upon her lips? Was it a smile? A small, reluctant smile? Yes. I'm fed up with you. Immediately began to dissolve once more. They were halfway down the parking lane when 2 figures appeared in the headlights, walking toward the Elf in Balzac's. 2 girls, dark-haired, chattering away, apparently having just parked their car. They couldn't have been more than 19 or 20. The girls and the trolling Elf drew close rapidly. The girls were wearing denim shorts with the belt lines down perilously close to the Mons Veneris, and the pants legs cut off up to here, practically up to the hip socket and left frayed. Their young legs looked model girl long since they also wore gleaming heels at least 6 inches high. The heels seemed to be made of lucite or something. They lit up a brilliant translucent gold when light hit them. The 2 girls' eyes were so heavily mascaraed, they appeared to be floating in 4 black pools.
Oh, that's attractive, Mac muttered.
Ed couldn't take his eyes off them. They were Latinas, although he couldn't have explained why he knew that any more than he knew that Latina and Latino were Spanish words that existed only in America. This pair of Latinas, yes, they were trashy, all right, but Mac's irony couldn't alter the truth. Attractive? Attractive barely began to describe what he felt. Such nice, tender, long legs the 2 girls had. Such short little short shorts. So short, they could shed them just like that. In an instant, they could lay bare their juicy little loins and perfect little cupcake bottoms. For him. And that was obviously what they wanted. He could feel the tumescence men live for welling up beneath his jockey tighty-whities. Oh, ineffable dirty girls. As Mac trolled past them, one of the dirty girls pointed at the green Elf, and both started laughing. Laughing, eh? Apparently they had no appreciation of how upscale Green was, or how hip the Elf was, or how cool. Even less could they conceive of the Elf, fully loaded as it was, with green accessories and various esoteric environmental meters, plus Protex Deer radar. They couldn't conceive of this little Elf of a car costing $135,000.
We've just heard Back to Blood by Tom Wolfe. My guest today, Stacey London, is one of the hosts of the Learning Channel's incredibly popular What Not to Wear. Stacey joined the show after years working for American Vogue and Mademoiselle. She's worked on style with some A-list celebrities, including Kate Winslet and Katie Holmes, and she consults for some very hot designers. In 2005, she joined NBC's Today as a style correspondent. She's appeared on Oprah, Tyra, Wendy Williams, and Access Hollywood. Stacey is also a contributing editor at People Magazine. Stacey grew up in Manhattan, attended Vassar, and graduated Phi Beta Kappa. She and her cat, Al, live in Brooklyn with her shoe collection. Today, we're getting down to The Truth About Style, her new book. Welcome, Stacey. Thanks so much for stopping by the book report.
Thanks for having me, Elaine.
The truth about your book, The Truth About Style, is that it spotlights 9 women. Why did you think to structure the book in this way?
Well, because originally, you know, book publishers that I met with had asked me to do more of an autobiography. And for a lot of reasons, I guess maybe I wasn't really ready for that. I'm 43. I have more things to do. You know, I'm not really ready to write a memoir. But I thought that it was important to talk a little bit about my past because it informs my philosophy of style so much. My philosophy of style does not just come from having dressed other people for a long time. So I thought that I would enlist other women actually to tell their stories and help me tell my story. So I wanted a kind of a cross-section of women to talk about sort of universal beliefs that I think sometimes get in our way when it comes to really creating our own style.
You write about the difference between a makeover and a start over, and I love to share that with our readers.
Well, you know, I think we traditionally think of the makeover thing as like, look, now I look different. These are the clothes that are different. And the start over was more about this mindset. I realize now, actually, that the book is out, and I really want to change it for the paperback. Instead of even a start over, I want to call them jump starts. And the reason that I realize that they're jump starts is because, you know, if you look at the book the way it's structured, each chapter is a different woman, which starts with a black and white portrait of her and then a kind of a color portrait at the end, with an analysis of the new clothes that we've put her in and why they help kind of allow her to see herself differently. And, you know, one outfit can never tell you how to dress. It can't tell any woman, you know, any women are, we're too multidimensional to say this outfit is the only thing that represents us. But those outfits do represent a pivot, a change in the way that they were able to see themselves, which allows for a new path in the way that they are going to take their style forward. And, you know, in some ways we do that on What Not to Wear, but this was very specific to a particular mindset that is holding each of these women back and that I think we all can relate to. You know, things like fear of judgment, fear of making a mistake, living in the future, when I lose 20 pounds, when the kids, you know, grow up and I have more time, what it means to kind of have style and age, our marital status, you know, our husband doesn't care, or we're single and we're dating, all of the things that inform our lives in a way where style may become either, you know, a tool or it can be a real obstacle depending on how we approach it.
I know that one of your principles of style is to accept what you've been given. And I also know that's unbelievably hard because so many of us want to put things off until we lose that 15 pounds, exactly what you said.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. That acceptance, that yes, because I talk about this exercise of yes and in the book, it's really important. And I think that part of the reason that we do things like wait to lose the 15 pounds or tell ourselves that that's when, you know, we'll care about style is because we've become, you know, we live in a culture where we've become really used to looking to what advertising and even what the fashion industry is telling us we're supposed to look like. And that doesn't just mean skinny and young and rich. It's everything from these are the colors that you're supposed to wear this season. This is the pattern. You know, wear leather, whatever it is. And I don't think that the industry is wrong at all for doing that. I am absolutely not interested in demonizing the fashion industry. What worries me is that we're losing our autonomy in allowing any industry to tell us how to feel about something. And that we're allowing the industry to tell us what it is that we're supposed to wear as opposed to what we want to wear, and through self-knowledge, what we know looks good on us. So rather than being told, here are your trends, great, fine, we should still be choosing the trends that work for us, picking and choosing what works for us, instead of comparing ourselves to the images that we see and trying to look like somebody we're not. We should be using the fashion industry to help us enhance who we are as individuals. I'm talking about fashion is the industry, and style starts with the individual, not what the industry dictates.
And as you write in the book, style ends with an E for emotion. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, I have this theory, and this is a big tenet in the book. You know, we all know the kind of shorthand term, and it's, you know, it's really an aphorism of sorts, that seeing is believing. I think when it comes to style, it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's also, you know, the reason that I think What Not to Wear is such a popular show, and the reason that it works, is because you can see a change. Now, when you can see a change, that can literally make you feel something different. And if you can feel something different, I think you can think differently about something. And if you can think differently, then you can believe something different and new about yourself. So there's a bigger kind of cycle going on there. And that's why style is such an incredible tool that we have at our disposal to change these kind of negative beliefs that we may have been carrying around about ourselves forever, because it is this quick, visceral shakeup of a change that makes us see that, you know, things, different things are possible.
You've always said that shoes are a game changer, but do they have to be high heels?
No. I mean, I think every woman should own a few pairs of high heels, absolutely. But no, I love flats. And, you know, there's this great trend right now of menswear and brogues and wingtips for women that with like a little cropped trouser looks absolutely adorable. I have nothing against flats. But, you know, there is a power to wearing high heels. It changes your posture. And for a lot of women, it makes them feel powerful. I'm just saying, don't discount that.
All right. Now, let's talk about the show for a minute. Did you and Clinton know each other before the show, or you just met? No.
Yeah, I know. Well, now we do. I mean, you know, we've been working together for 9 years. We're like a brother and sister on a very long car trip.
Well, you certainly have wonderful chemistry on the show.
Thank you.
One of your great fans of the show had this question that she begged me to ask you. Most of us don't get a credit card with $5,000 on it to start over their style. So what are the first elements you would recommend if budget is a very real limitation?
Well, I think that, you know, budget is a real limitation for almost everybody. And style does not have a price point. I think the first thing that you need to do is really look in your closet to figure out what's missing and what's not working. You really have to start with that edit. And that, you know, you don't have to be as harsh as maybe we are on the show in throwing things in the trash. You can certainly give things to charity, put things on consignment. But, you know, I believe that clothing has to serve, you know, it has to at least fulfill one of two criteria. Ideally, both. But they are utility and joy. And then anything that doesn't bring you joy, anything that doesn't make you happy to put on, get rid of it. Why do you want that in your closet? And then I would say it's really about looking at the pieces that you need. You make a laundry list. You would not go shopping at a grocery store without a grocery list, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't go to bake a cake without ingredients and having that list of ingredients. That's exactly what you need to do when looking at your closet. I need a better pair of black pants. I need a great fitting jacket. I, you know what? I'd love something like a floral blouse to kind of perk up my neutral bottoms. You have to look at your clothes and your closet, see what's there, and then see what's not, and ideally what you wish was. You make that list, and then you work within your budget. You may not acquire everything at once. Maybe you get one piece every few months. But you check them off the list. And then you start to have a wardrobe not only that you love, but that works together. You know, style is a muscle. Having style is like building muscle. The more you do it, the better you get at it, the stronger you get at it. So you really need to go out there and start trying things to understand what is going to work on you.
All right. And after the book tour, what's next for you?
Well, I go back to shooting What Not to Wear. We're on hiatus right now. And I'm still, you know, running Style for Hire. And I have a production company, and I have 4 shows in development that I am trying to produce instead of be in. And I have a jewelry collection coming out, so I'm pretty excited.
Oh, and where can we find that jewelry collection?
I can't say yet, but hopefully it will be very soon and there will be an announcement.
Stacey, thank you so much. I loved your book. It's really accessible and fun to read with wonderful ideas. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Elaine. Really appreciate it.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
And for the fashionistas on your list, Karen Carbo delves into the long, extraordinary life of the renowned fashion designer in The Gospel According to Coco Chanel, Life Lessons from the World's Most Elegant Woman. The book is an exploration of Chanel's philosophy on a range of universal themes, from style to passion, money, and to living life on your own terms. Chanel is credited not only with giving us the little black dress, but for popularizing pants for women and easy, practical clothes that allowed women a chic freedom they'd never known. In her strong-headed, elegant, passionate, entirely French way, Chanel helped bring women into the modern era. She was the only person in fashion to be named one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people of the 20th century. Carbo weaves Chanel's life story into themes that subtly convey life lessons. And while the great Coco may have launched her empire 100 years ago, her methods and attitude are as relevant and modern as ever. Bernadette Dunn narrates.
For nearly 100 years, Coco Chanel has been synonymous with every piece of clothing we consider stylish, and with lots of stuff to which we never give a thought. Throw open your closet door, and you will find the spirit of Chanel. If you have a collection of jackets for tossing on over a pair of jeans, the better to look as if you've actually dressed for the occasion, as opposed to simply parked the lawnmower, given your nails a once-over with a nail brush, and walked out the door, that's Chanel. Any black dress is a direct descendant of Chanel's 1926 short silk model. A knee-grazing pencil or A-line skirt? Chanel. Jersey anything? Chanel again. She gave us real pockets, bell bottoms, twin sets, drop waists, belted cardigans, short dresses for evening, sportswear including riding breeches, and the need to accessorize madly at all times. Anything that's got simple lines, skims the body, is easy to move in, and affords the loading on of a lot of jewelry is Chanel. So too is anything in which prettiness trumps quirkiness. Chanel ran screaming from the latest fads. She considered them to be expressions of cheesy grandstanding, and anyway, they rarely held to her standards of simple elegance. Thus, ponchos, stirrup pants, or backless dresses cut in a manner that reveals your thong are definitely not Chanel. If you own anything that has epaulets and you are not in the armed forces, an unnecessary amount of fabric, ill-fitting arms, or Hulk-sized shoulder pads, it is not Chanel. Anything related to the grunge revival featuring ripped tights that look as if you've barely survived a mugging? No. Anything in which you cannot breathe, sit down, or get into a car without flashing your lady bits? Well, I don't even need to say it. When Chanel observed that not all women have the figure of Venus, yet nothing should be hidden, this is not what she was talking about. Note, actually, a lot of us do. What we don't have is the flat-chested, slim-hipped figure of Chanel. To clarify, she meant that the loose, long t-shirts we reserve for fat days do nothing but make us look fatter. The Chanel aesthetic is like the Force in Star Wars. surrounding, penetrating, and binding together the universe of fashion now and forever. As I write this, I'm wearing a pair of J. Crew boy jeans. Even though they're square through the hip with straight legs and a button fly, they are cunningly cut to prevent your looking like an appliance box. And a chocolate brown long sleeve cashmere t-shirt. Both pieces descend straight from Chanel's once shocking ideas that with a smidge of fancying up, menswear could be easily retooled for the ladies, and soft, body-defining fabrics, some of which were normally used for underwear, could make the simplest garment seem luxe. When we enter the realm of garments issued from the house of Chanel itself, things get more complicated. I think of everything that was designed by Coco herself, from her first straw boater in the early 1900s to the last jacket of her last collection in 1970, to be Chanel. All pieces that date from 1983, when the redoubtable Karl Lagerfeld took over and revitalized the fashion house, are Lagerfeld Chanel. Note: between 1971 and 1983, the house wandered in the wilderness, so to speak. Gaston Berthelot designed from 1971 to 1973. Jean Casaubon and Yvonne Dudel took over from there. Philippe Guibourget designed a ready-to-wear in 1978, and someone named Ramon Esparza showed up in 1980. There are, in addition, high-end knockoffs that pass as Chanel. Discussion still rages over whether the pink Chanel suit Jackie Kennedy wore on the day her husband was shot was a genuine Chanel or a copy whipped up by a New York dressmaker, and knockoffs of Lagerfeld's semi-annual collections, which usually riff on Mademoiselle's ladylike suits, gold chains, quilted bags, and the iconic interlocking C's. There are also, stay with me, mass-market copies of the higher-end knockoffs. Mavens of haute couture and certain bloggers spend a shocking number of hours keeping it all straight. Here is my stab at sorting it all out.
That was The Gospel According to Coco Chanel by Karen Carbo. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineer stone, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And since 'tis the season to make dreams come true, Lifestyles Kitchens offers full or partial gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's. lifestyleskitchens.com. Happy holidays! When Garrison Keillor muses about the manic evolution of Christmas present, you know you're in for a tale that could charm the pants off Scrooge. In A Christmas Blizzard, a wealthy and depressed man bound for Christmas in the tropics is suddenly summoned home to North Dakota to visit an ailing aunt. He arrives just in time to be trapped there by a blizzard. The electricity goes out, and when it does, figures from his childhood appear, as do historical figures, making it a candlelit holiday to remember. In his reverie, our man reaches an epiphany worthy of the season. He hears the hearkening angels sing, he is awed by the silence of the night, and when he is finally rescued, he leaves North Dakota resolved to simplify his life. The author narrates.
Mrs. Sparrow attended two nutcrackers every year, two messiahs, and three A Christmas Carol. She loved Christmas so much, and also she served on the boards of directors of the ballet and the symphony and the theater. Mr. Sparrow wished that the mice would carry Clara away and lock her in a dungeon, and that the Hallelujah Chorus could be embargoed for 10 years. And that Tiny Tim would learn a useful trade and quit blessing people. poor Mr. Dickinson, the juggernaut he had wrought. Back when he wrote about Scrooge and the Nebuchadnezzar Cratchits, Christmas was a one-day event like Valentine's Day, Memorial Day, and you did the thing on that day and it was over. But his little book created a rage of Christmas, and it spread out of control. Now the good man would be horrified to see it. The incessant dinging of bells, the god-awful music seeping out of cracks in ceilings like liquid gas, the anguished jollity of store clerks living in the hell of holiday shopping, the invitations to parties where people who don't like each other stand cheek to jowl at a downtown club and get glassy-eyed on artillery punch. Mr. Sparrow's company, Coyote Corporation, did not do Christmas parties. His 325 employees were sent nice bonus checks and given a week off, but nothing to do with Christmas. Thank you very much. There was no glittery tree in the lobby, no wreaths, no candles. He hoisted himself up on one elbow and gazed at her, earplugs in place, his true love in her cardigan sweater, soft purple pants and red socks, and groped for the bedside lamp and knocked a book off the stack on the bedside table and also his eye drops and almost spilled a glass of juice. Mrs. Sparrow turned over but did not open her eyes. He put the glass to his lips and cranberry juice. Simon had left him a glass of cranberry juice. Why? The mere taste of it brought back bitter memories, the boredom of breast of turkey, the big yawn of yams, the pointlessness of pumpkin. It was the digital clock radio Simon had installed that Mr. Sparrow had never figured out. The thing cost $14,000, an iClock with an e-radio and a P-phone with video cam that could access bank accounts, activate a coffee maker, download a newspaper, start a robot vacuum cleaner or trouser press, open up email and have it read to you in a pleasant Australian female voice who would also say your schedule for the day. 9 a.m., you have a breakfast meeting with Mr. Jeepers here at Wabasha Towers. This concerns tax liability. And if you wished to change the schedule, you could get the Australian lady to call Mr. Jeepers' voicemail and deliver the message. This is a recorded message from Mr. James Sparrow. He is very sorry, but he is forced to cancel your breakfast meeting today at 9 a.m. He apologizes for any inconvenience this may cause, and he will be in touch with you as soon as possible. Thank you, and have a wonderful day. It was a marvelous device made by BRB Incorporated, a wholly owned subsidiary of Mr. Sparrow's Coyote Corporation, and he didn't know how to turn it off.
We've just heard A Christmas Blizzard by Garrison Keillor.
Readers, relax. There's still some days left before the big holiday. Time to tie up your last-minute chores. Or, for all you procrastinators, and you know who you are, time to get down to it. And maybe this year, not wait for December 24th. Whichever category you fall in, a great book does make a cherished gift. Check my website, bookreportradio.com, for hundreds of ideas. Thanks for taking time from your busy schedule to join me today. And see you back here next week on The Book Report.